My name is Mel Peel, and this is the session on Catholic social thought in America, which is the second in the series I'm doing on Catholicism, and beginning tomorrow I'm going to be talking about a very particular Roman Catholic social movement, the Catholic worker. Yesterday I talked very briefly, obviously, about Roman Catholicism in America in general. Today I'm narrowing it somewhat and talking a little bit about how Catholics have viewed particularly society in relation to social justice. I'm not attempting to cover the whole spectrum of social thought or social existence as it might be conceived, including things like marriage, family life, education, a whole range of things, but concentrating particularly on the development in the ways in which American Catholics in relation to their church have thought about the problem of social justice. And I would reinforce the point that I made yesterday. It seems to me that all religion in general engages in an interaction between its universal dimensions that it claims to derive from some inherent principles, whatever those are, in relation to particular historical circumstances and times, including societies. And I think what you can say about religion in general is true in spades for social thought. That is, to the extent that religion begins to engage itself with problems of society, it has even further dimension of attempting to relate what it conceives to be its essential convictions or truths to the particular circumstances in which it finds itself. And as I said yesterday too, it seems to me that America, for Roman Catholicism, which is of course a very ancient Christian tradition and a very universal one, has had a very difficult and but often interesting time in relating to American society and culture, which I think it's fair to say is unlike any society and culture that the Catholic Church has previously encountered before in its long existence, and that's presented certain very particular challenges. In general, I would say about a broad generalization about American Catholic social thought that I'm going to trace a little bit historically is that, like most kinds of religious thought, it occurs in an interaction between sort of the official teachings of the church, what is taught in a sense by the spiritual authority, as Roman Catholics define that, the official teaching authority residing in the apostolic college of the bishops, as Roman Catholics conceive of that teaching authority, the interaction between that official teaching and all the ordinary processes of society that go on, all the kinds of movements, all the kind of interactions, all the kinds of ideas that pop up all over the place in society, and particularly in the religious communities of society. And what you have then is a kind of reciprocal process in which ideas are sort of always bubbling up from the bottom. You have an authoritative body that, in a sense, thinks of itself as sorting through those ideas and relating them to the more universal traditions, interpreting them in light of the long history and presumably eternal principles by which the church operates, then teaching back to the society then responding to that teaching, giving in a sense more feedback to the teaching authority, and so on, a process of that kind. That's the way in which at least some kinds of Roman Catholic thinkers would think about this process of social thought. And I think it's fair to say that to some extent anyhow, in American society, which is a very unusual one with its emphasis upon liberty and equality and democracy and so on, this kind of process has gone on. And I'm going to trace that just a little bit. So I think that it's important to note that there are, in a sense, these two sources of Catholic social thought. One, but they are related. One, the all kinds of movements and developments and ideas popping up all over the place by people who are in religious life, from the society, from all sorts of movements. And then the teaching that is sort of incorporated by the official Roman Catholic teaching authority, which in at least in traditional Roman Catholic thought has great weight. The official term for this, for anyone who may be interested, is magisterium. One of the neat things about learning about Catholicism is you get to, even if you're not a Latin scholar, you get to pick up all these neat long Latin words and terms, and magisterium is one of them, the official teaching authority of the church, which is then broken down into the ordinary magisterium and the extraordinary magisterium, and you know, they just love to run out these distinctions to five levels of complexity. It's interesting too, generalization before I begin, to say that it seems to me it's rather interesting if we look at Catholic social thought and teaching in the United States, that a couple of forms of Catholic social thought and action that have been very prominent in Europe, for example, have hardly ever appeared in this country. One is the officially sanctioned Catholic lay movement. In a lot of parts of Europe, and also incidentally in Quebec, in Canada, which is of course a heavily French Catholic area, you have sort of organized lay movements run by the hierarchy, but then with laymen or lay people sort of organized into an official body behind the hierarchy, and those become the major agencies of Catholic social thought and action. And there were little attempts at that in this country, but they've hardly ever caught on, and it's interesting to ask why that might be so. Something about the atmosphere of the culture here has never permitted that to be very popular. Another one, of course, is the Roman Catholic political party. This country has never had what is very common in Europe and also in Latin America, which is political parties organized along confessional lines. And if you go to Europe, for example, in most countries, certainly any country with a significant Catholic minority, you will have what are called Christian democratic parties, which usually means Roman Catholic, although in some places they also include Protestants. And those parties are also very common in Latin America. And again, the political atmosphere here, and that's the subdivision of society in a sense, has never allowed for, permitted, encouraged. Catholics in themselves have never felt, even in their worst moments of being sort of persecuted, have never felt called upon to organize a separate political party. So those are sort of the negatives that have never been on the board here. And instead what we have, I think, in American Catholicism and Catholic social history in relation to social justice is a very rich process of interaction between the society and, as I said, these official teaching authorities. Let me just give a couple of instances of this and start off and sort of run through historically how I see this process working at various times. As I mentioned yesterday, the great period of the growth of American Catholicism was in the 19th century when all these immigrants came in, and they were almost all poor, and they were almost all working class, and they were almost all in cities, and they were almost all in laboring kinds of jobs that were very, very vulnerable. So naturally, at some point, as the labor movements began to take hold in this country, many of them joined into what became the great labor organizations. And one of the first very important ones in the 19th century United States was called the Knights of Labor. And the Knights of Labor was a sort of curious organization by contemporary labor standards. It was a sort of all-purpose reform organization. Anybody could join it, except I think they excluded lawyers, gamblers, and bankers. were the only three categories of people whose work was considered socially useless. So everybody else could join as a member of the Knights of Labor. So it wasn't quite a labor union by our conventional standards. Another curious feature about it was that it was organized as a secret society, a lodge, in effect. Where there were secret meetings and elaborate rituals and enormous hierarchies and secret handshakes and all that great stuff. Well, this presented a very great challenge to the Catholic Church because Catholicism, like I think most branches of Lutheranism in this country originally, did not like this whole lodge connection and the whole process that went on there. So here you had a labor movement into which hundreds of thousands of Catholics were pouring, and how would Catholicism in America react to this? Many people were condemning it. Many people, bishops, were proposing to condemn it. And it looked like, at one point, that the Pope might even come out and say, any Catholic who joins such an organization is going to be cut off from the church. But in 1887, Cardinal Gibbons, who was the head of the hierarchy in the United States, essentially went to Rome and took the lead in saying that you better not condemn this. I really don't like a lot of this stuff. But the truth is that lots of our people are pouring into it, and it is based on a legitimate idea of finding social justice for the worker. And so therefore, if the church is not going to lose its following, we better say that this is a legitimate organization for Catholics to join. The statement he made to the Pope was rather interesting. It was not so much based on theological argument, and actually Gibbons himself, in many respects, was very anti-labor, very conservative, very hostile to anything that might stir up turmoil in society. But he was also a leader of his flock and knew which way the flock was going. And he said at one point, this is what he wrote to the Pope, to lose the heart of the people would be a misfortune for which the friendship of the few rich and powerful would be no compensation. So it's not exactly an argument saying, I believe in justice. It's to say that if we lose all the people who believe in justice, we won't have many troops behind us. Very pragmatic kind of argument, but it worked not to have a condemnation of the Knights of Labor. Actually, shortly after that, the Knights of Labor were implicated in the Haymarket incident in Chicago. They collapsed, and labor went a whole different direction in the United States. Well, a similar kind of process in relation, I should say here, to the Universal Church as well, might be said to be going on. And beginning early on in the 19th century already, you also have the popes beginning to make statements about social concern and social justice. And I'm not going to go into any detail on this, but just mention a couple of these papal documents that also provide reinforcement for this process in the United States. The first major one was an encyclical, Rerum Novarum, 1891. This was the first real statement after the whole century of the French Revolution, in which Roman Catholicism had allied itself very firmly with European monarchy, hierarchy, authority, rigidly reactionary kinds of principles. This was a statement that said the church needs to reach out to the ordinary person, to the working person, to attempt to look for principles of defense of the rights of laborers, for example. And one of the statements in Rerum Novarum, human labor cannot be treated simply as a commodity, but belongs to the worker himself. Well, the principles under which this are elaborated are very complicated, and they actually probably have a lot more to do with medieval thought in a lot of ways than they do with anything that we would think of as modern social thought. But nevertheless, it's this same kind of idea that the church does not simply look at people and their labor from an economic point of view, but also from a wider social point of view. Well, out of this, even though these particular movements did not develop along the lines that Gibbons or the Pope or whatever said they would, in a sense, this kind of thing, and also the movements from the bottom in interaction, gave legitimacy to at least to those Catholics in the United States who wanted to do things like work with unions and help to organize labor and so on. Now, shouldn't say this is universal, but already early on in the 20th century, you have the tradition of the worker priest, a priest who might be encouraging the people in his parish to join labor unions, or at least supporting them if they do join labor unions. Or then you begin to get sort of nationally influential priests who sort of speak out for the cause of labor and work in association with labor unions. Now, interestingly, again, in the United States, this tradition is very hostile to any kind of anything that might smack of socialism or communism. Communism immediately is a tremendous bugaboo. So, for example, when the unions get organizing, get to be organized, they often include very strict statements, no influence from socialists whatsoever. And the Catholic Church could endorse that very strongly then. And many of the Catholics who entered into the AFL, for example, early on, the AFL just fit perfectly as a social organization because it defended the rights of working people, but it was also militantly anti-communist, anti-socialistic, presumably even anti-atheistic things that would be a threat to religion. So that tradition of the worker priest becomes a very strong one and carries on through much of the early 20th century in the United States. Another kind of Catholic social thought tradition that develops in this country is comes from a somewhat different kind of motive and involves a different sort of process, I suppose. And this is a sort of philosophical reflection on the problem of social justice from a Catholic point of view, leading to moral assertions and statements in relation to the government. And the most influential person in this regard was a person named Father John A. Ryan, who actually grew up in Minnesota during the era of populist protest and all this, went to Catholic university, got a thoroughly Thomist kind of education in all the philosophical traditions of the Catholic Church, and then began examining what he saw as the problems of American society. And what he would do then would be to analyze the whole society in these very traditional Thomist kinds of terms in order to decide on what should be the policies that the church and the state should advocate. To give an example of this and how this process works, you would start off, for example, with universal truths that are belong to all men of reason in the Thomist tradition, such as that human beings are endowed by God with natural dignity and reason, being created in the image of God. From that kind of universal theological statement, you then move on to general principles of human dignity in society. Then you move on to specify certain particular human rights, such as the right of the person to the fruits of their labor. And from then you reason through elaborate processes your way down to say, well, if you're working for wages, you deserve a just fruit of your labor. And from that you reason to the idea of a minimum wage. And from there you can even reason further to determine exactly what the minimum wage is. And Ryan would do exactly that kind of thing. And therefore, he could walk into a congressional committee and say, you see, you must establish a minimum wage of $1.15 an hour. Do you know why? Because of, and then expound this entire chain of Thomist reasoning. Not always did he give your average Congress people the full line of Thomist reasoning, but this kind of thing became very powerful. It became very important in the development of Catholic social thought in the United States, primarily operating through the government. And what Ryan was best at was going to the state and saying, do you understand that in order to be a just state, these are the things that you ought to be doing? His program really culminated in 1919. He succeeded in getting the bishops to adopt what's called the Bishops' Program of Social Reconstruction. This is actually fairly early on. And let me just mention some of the things that the Bishops' Program of Social Reconstruction called for. A minimum wage, as I mentioned, specified as what would require a head of a family to support his family at a minimal standard of decency. And Ryan had this all worked out. Unemployment insurance, health and old age insurance, child labor laws, the right of labor to organize, public housing, and worker participation in the management of industry. That was the Bishop's program, all elaborately worked out. And this is what the government should institute in order to fulfill the proper terms of social justice. Well, of course, a lot of those were not implemented right away, but rather interestingly, if you think about it, many of those things eventually developed, particularly in the period of the New Deal and so on. Yes, sir?
Could you repeat those again?
Okay, yeah, I know we're competing a little bit with the our enthusiastic staff.
Next, I'd like to hear.
Okay. These are some of the social policies that the bishops in 1919 said that the government of the United States, or the states, should implement as minimum requirements of social justice. And they were a minimum wage law, you may not pay someone less than this, unemployment insurance, health and old age insurance, essentially the way Social Security was initially defined, child labor laws, prohibiting children under a certain age working, the right of labor to organize, public housing, and worker participation in the management of industry. This was the most startling one. This was the one that actually led the president of the National Association of Manufacturers to say that somehow a communist had infiltrated into the Catholic bishops' meeting and was somehow going to undermine fundamental American principles, and it's the one that certainly has never been implemented. But many of the others at the time were considered fairly progressive, although there were lots of other people advocating these things at the same time. But what's interesting here, this is the sort of core of what I would call the liberal Catholic social tradition in the United States, which has been a very strong tradition, primarily operating among sort of educated Catholic reforming elites, people who are involved in the church's social justice operations, understand these kinds of thoughts and principles and work through the government to implement these things. But here too, I think you can see this process of someone like Ryan promoting this sort of cause the bishops finally adopting it as an official policy. Even if many of them did not fully understand all the elaborate reasoning behind it, and then actually promoting it before various official governments, agencies, and so on. And during the New Deal, a good deal of this was implemented. And Ryan, in fact, he was often called the Right Reverend New Dealer because he sort of hung around with the people who hung around with Roosevelt's advisors, and there were sort of Jewish and Catholic people involved there. To move ahead to the period of the 1930s, I would indicate that this is another time in American Catholic history, and perhaps in the history of the United States generally, where you had a great many social movements and ideas and activities sort of bubbling up from below. Lots of people worried when the Depression, the whole society seemed to collapse, and this sort of creates social ferment, creates social movement. Lots of people have to ask, something is wrong with how we're currently organized, how we're currently acting, how can we act differently? And again, out of Catholicism, as well as out of other traditions, you get a great variety of movements and ideas. Really, this is a very creative period for American Catholic social thought. Certainly, this liberal Catholic tradition, as I said, flourished during this time. It was in turn reinforced by another papal encyclical issued in 1931, Quadragesimo Anno, which simply means 40 years. These papal encyclicals always take their title from the first two words of the Latin. So that was 40 years after Rerum Novarum. The Pope at that time sort of reinforced the teachings of Leo XIII, his predecessor, and again from a somewhat different perspective, endorsed the idea that Catholics should attain justice in society and so on. But besides those official teachings, you also had a great variety of movements popping up in the American Catholic community of all kinds and of all sorts of outlooks and backgrounds. And I'll just mention a couple of these. Some of them, by our present standards, I would say are rather dubious. Probably the most famous one of the 1930s was Father Charles Coughlin, who became the great radio priest out of Royal Oak, Michigan. Had this tremendous radio voice and great charisma. And the stories were that you could walk through Irish or Polish neighborhoods of Chicago or Boston, and you didn't even have to have a radio. Walking along the street, you could listen to Father Coughlin because his radio voice was coming out of every house along the street. So you could walk along and follow the speech without even having your Sony Walkman along. He was so popular. His solution of the New Deal included things like a tax on bankers, Jews, communists as the sources of the evils, and calls for a thorough Christian reorganization of society along Christian lines, which he defined in terms largely drawn from European, Austrian social Catholicism. But you also had a great many other movements sort of popping up all over the place, usually small but often fairly creative, and I'll just mention a couple of these. Labor movements, again, were very important. A lot of Catholics involved in the formation of the CIO, and some of them formed independent Catholic movements within the labor movement, the Association of Catholic Trade Unionists, whose principles were to create Christian principles inside labor and to battle against communists and gangsters. So these were sort of, often associated with worker priests. I think this ended up in some of these movies, too, where you see the sort of labor priest down there battling on the waterfront against both the communists and criminals attempting to promote social justice for the good, decent working person. You also had racial movements, interracial movements like Friendship House, some movements among young people, young Christian student movements, Christian worker movements, and then the movement that I'm most interested in, the Catholic worker movement founded in 1933 by Dorothy Day and Peter Morin. And I'll hold off that one and save a little suspense for tomorrow. That was a very different kind of social movement formed in the 1930s. From there, let me just leap ahead one more period and to sort of describe some of the transitions that occurred after World War II, 1950s. I mentioned yesterday that what happened in that period is that Catholics, like I suppose the rest of American society, tended to become more prosperous, more affluent, more suburbanized. No longer were they people of the poor or the working class. A lot of these movements that had been founded on, for example, principles of labor organization, once the laborers raised their status, were able to enjoy more of the prosperity, moved to the suburbs, they sort of left a lot of that behind, or at least their children did. Their children then went off to colleges, moved out into different kinds of neighborhoods. So a lot of those earlier movements sort of faded or lost a lot of their spirit that they'd had earlier on. But there were new kinds of social movements popping up in the society at large, but that Catholics were also participating in that period. And just to mention again a few of these, certainly the most important, I think, in shaping Catholic social thought in the 1960s and after was the civil rights movement. I suppose we don't normally think of, most of us don't think of, the Catholics particularly involved in civil rights. We think of Martin Luther King or perhaps some of the other leaders. But as in the American religious community in general, there were was a great deal of ferment involved in the civil rights movement and the civil rights protest. Already early on, you had some bishops saying things like Catholic schools must be integrated. But once Martin Luther King's movement began growing and the civil rights movement in general began growing, you did have substantial numbers of Catholics becoming involved, particularly people involved in what I would call secondary leadership positions. Priests, nuns, certain kinds of Catholic social activists popping up involved with the civil rights movement. And one of the startling things people noticed, for example, in the marches in Birmingham and Selma, for example, were that there were sisters marching along in the train of civil rights. And this was very startling, I suppose, not just to Catholics, but to other people as well. One thing a Roman Catholic sister didn't do was to march in a social protest. You also had people like Father James Groppi in Milwaukee, who some people might know of, who was a very active priest. You had Father Philip Berrigan actually began, his original work was with the Josephite Fathers, whose mission was among blacks, and a lot of other people speaking out and thinking about problems of race and social justice. Someone like Thomas Merton, for example, who'd been a very famous Catholic spiritual writer, suddenly through friendships with a lot of other people, including Dorothy Day and including the Berrigans, being drawn into issues of race and social justice. You also have things like, more traditional, but from a somewhat different standpoint, something like Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers as a very distinctly religious social movement popping up. In some ways, the United Farm Workers movement had, in Catholic terms, Catholic American social terms, a sort of old-fashioned quality to it. It was closer to something that people remembered from this earlier era, because Chavez himself was this obviously very pious Catholic who before every march would take Mass and always had images of the Madonna at the front of the processions when they would advocate their union and so on. At a time in which more and more Catholics, even if they were becoming involved in social concerns, were sort of muting the religious dimension of their involvement and emphasizing the social dimension. So that's another aspect of the movement of that period. I don't want to go into all the consequences of that, and obviously we know that time in American history in general was one in which there was a great deal of social ferment again, and a lot of people re-examining these questions of society and social justice from a somewhat different standpoint. But that certainly affected the Catholic Church and the Catholic hierarchy and the Catholic bishops as well. And the last thing I'll mention again then is the phase of Catholic social thought that appears to be going on at present, or very recently in the 1980s in the United States. It's one of these periods again where there's a sort of gathering up of all these things that have been bubbling around in the society, and interpretation and evaluation of them in light of Roman Catholicism's self-understanding and what it sees as its more universal traditions, and then official pronouncements and teachings being issued in the name of the magisterium, the bishop's official social teachings. And the two, of course, that have come out most publicly and have really had a substantial public impact are the Bishop's Pastoral Letter on Nuclear War, which was issued in 1983, which nearly everyone, I believe, has heard about, certainly anyone that is all aware of social questions, social consciousness in the United States, and then the Bishop's Pastoral Letter on the Economy, which I think the date is 1986 when it was officially promulgated to the people of the United States. Well, perhaps in the conversation we can talk a little bit about the content of those pastoral letters. To me, what's very interesting and very significant in terms of the way that Catholic social thought has interacted with American society is the process by which those pastoral letters were written. Traditionally, the way that Catholic bishops make their pronouncements on any subject is to read all the relevant literature, withdraw to a cloister, read all the proper theologians, pray a good deal, and then issue these pronouncements. What they did in this case was to engage in a very wide-ranging public process of open hearings all around the United States in which all kinds of people were invited to come and testify. All kinds of Catholics, all kinds of non-Catholics, all kinds of experts, all kinds of officials, all were contributing to this process. Then they would put out what they called drafts of the letter. Everybody's invited to comment on these drafts of a letter. Then they would submit the draft to Rome, let the Pope offer his comments. They would revise certain things again, hold more meetings, readjust the letters, and so on and so on. And this process itself is almost as fascinating as the letters that occurred. And at some point, for example, to show you the kind of dance that went on here, at one point, the first draft said that it should be the policy of the United States government to halt all testing, production, and deployment of any new nuclear weapon. Okay, that little statement, bang, was in there. Well, it was right at that point that this letter began getting the attention of people in the State Department, the Defense Department, and the administration. Up to this point, they thought it's the usual thing, you know, religious people out running around and nobody listens to them. But at some point, it began dawning on the people in the government that this process that the Catholic bishops had developed was attaining a kind of influence that was very distressing. And so immediately, for example, many of the influential Catholics in the Reagan administration started hopping on the phone to their influential clerical friends and calling up Rome and saying, look, you know, if you start saying this stuff and this turns into political pressure, this is going to undermine our policy in relation to NATO. It's going to cause our allies to begin to react and so on and so on. So they went through various procedures and to get the term halt changed to curb. Okay, so at one point in the second draft, out comes the word curb the production, testing, and deployment of new nuclear weapons. But at that point, Cardinal Bernardine or someone went over to Rome, checked out with the Pope, and the Pope said, no, really, curb isn't so is too wishy-washy. It would be okay if you said halt. So in the final draft, they stuck halt back in there. I think they were also irritated at the people who played this political game on them, so they put halt right back in there. That's the kind of battle that went on over a single word. And actually, that kind of battle went on over all these clauses in that letter, which is what makes it a very interesting document, and we could talk about it from a number of standpoints, because there, in a sense, there are signals at all kinds of people in there. For example, it says that pacifism is a legitimate option for the church, but it also says that we strongly endorse the principle of a just war. But it also says that all Catholics should study the examples of Martin Luther King and Dorothy Day, are specifically cited by this magisterium of the church as examples for all good Catholics to study. And the principles of nonviolence should be examined thoroughly. I think that aspect of the letter has tended to drop out in this big debate over can you use nuclear weapons or not, and so on and so on. Those are simply examples. And a similar kind of process on the pastoral letter on the economy. But so this is the phase in which we have this official teaching from on top. But I think the process, if you think about it, one of the things many people have said is that it reflects the bishop's own experience of American society and culture, in which leaders have to really listen hard to what's popping up from below, but also have to lead as well, so that the process by which they teach on society is one in which, in a sense, everyone is involved. So I think I'll stop at this point, and we can all talk about this and see your own comments and thoughts on any of this.
Do those letters, those pastoral letters, or the particularly the ones in the '80s, like the one that you wrote, do they impact society and government outside of the Catholic Church? And it's, you seem to indicate that they do because they drew on a lot of support, or they drew on a lot of people.
Good question. I mean, what do you think?
Does anybody who's not a Catholic pay any attention?
Let me mention just one thing. One of the things that Catholic documents often do, and this is an example, is to address themselves. They always start off by saying, this is addressed to all people of goodwill and to those who belong to the Roman Communion. And what you do then is you engage in certain kinds of assertions and arguments. In Catholic tradition, there's this view that everyone shares a certain kind of common reason, whether they are Christian or not, or religious or not. So you can appeal to people on the grounds of common reason that all human beings, if they are truly rational, share. Now, that's why it's been a big hooker in there. Well, what does that mean? And then you make different kinds of appeals to those who belong to the faith. Them, you've got a different kind of relationship to. A bishop does, presumably, has a whole different relationship to someone who belongs to the faithful communion of the Roman Catholic Church. And there you can say things like, well, we ought to look at the New and Old Testaments and Jesus and so on and so on, where, as if you're talking to people in general, you don't have to say that. But your question, we can test it here. I mean, do these things have any social impact, or is this like most church pronouncements, which most people ignore most of the time? I should say that there was lots of controversy.
And there was lots of publicity in the media.
Sure, and lots of Catholics, incidentally. I should say, too, lots of Catholics said, here we go, the bishops are turning left-wing, they're attacking Ronald Reagan, they're doing everything dangerous. Although it is much harder, I should say, for Catholics to ever argue that the church should not be involved in politics than it is for most Protestants, because one thing the Catholic Church has always been involved through its long centuries is politics. It takes a real act of heroism for a Roman Catholic to say the church should stay out of politics, because your whole tradition, you know, they've been at it longer than most people ever have. Yes, sir?
Well, I've gained a great appreciation for the Catholic Church from being a small town of about 10,000 when we started a nuclear, anti-nuclear arms reduction group. And through, I won't say all the churches we didn't try, but who ended up was we were able to get meetings, use the bulk mailing of the Catholic Church, even though there was only maybe 10% of our group Catholic, I don't even know if that much. So that the nitty-gritty was they provided a format for us because of that letter. Or the other churches, I shouldn't say all of them, but we didn't try all of them. But some of them definitely didn't want to have an announcement in the paper that the anti-nuclear group will be meeting in the Episcopal Church at such and such a time. They didn't want that in the paper, and so that's what we did. But we were able to do that in the Catholic Church. Is that just a foundation that worked? Not that the group was anything really big or really active, but just a basic groundwork. So I think it's important.
Does Raymond Hunhausen play into your outline here at all?
Well, he is one bishop. And of course, any bishop within his territory exerts a certain kind of religious authority. But as I understand it, for example, there have been several individual, as they're called, ordinaries, that is, bishops, who have issued all kinds of statements, but they usually have not done these. This gets very complicated in terms of the Catholic Church. At what level are their statements made? Now, in one sense, any time a bishop opens his mouth, he's considered to be teaching and he has a kind of authority. But there are different levels and kinds of statements that bishops make. So when someone like Hunhausen engages in action, if you read the statements, you'd be very surprised how careful he is to say what exactly he's doing and what kind of teaching he is making for his flock, whether it is a personal action, whether he is encouraging his flock to do it, whether he is ordering his flock to do it. And my suspicion is, if you read the documents carefully, that what he's saying is, this is what I understand the church to church's message and Jesus' message to be implying. I am acting on it. Watch me and think about it. I think essentially that's what he has said. That operates at a somewhat different level than the thing like the pastoral letter, which is issued as an official teaching document by the Catholic magisterium, which in effect, if you are a good Catholic, says, look here, pay attention, listen, and this is legitimate what we are teaching as successors of the apostles. I think that Hunthausen has not done that, because that kind of teaching is only, actually technically that kind of teaching is only done by all the bishops in the whole world together. So it's somewhat less when one national group of bishops does it. So there
why
are different.
Why has it got so much attention from Rome? You know, hasn't
it? Sure. Oh, sure it has. Sure. Because, again, anytime any Catholic bishop says anything, it gains attention from Rome. And when it goes against various kinds of social or political understandings that have been derived from there, they pay very close attention to all that. And people watch that very carefully. And political people watch that very carefully.
Was he corrected, I guess, is my question.
Essentially, the issue as it was formally raised, as I understand it, had to do with his administration of the diocese. Now, for those who are of a skeptical political bent, you say, in other words, it had to do with the ways in which he was permitting things like joint communion, not having confession, first confession before communion, the use of the church buildings for other kinds of activities, and so on and so on. Never in any of Rome's, the investigating commission that came in, you would not find the word nuclear, pacifist, anywhere in there. Nowhere. I leave it to your speculation. Was that in people's heads or not? Certainly there are those who would say indeed it was. They never ordered him to stop doing any of those political things at all. But they did send in for a while an adjutor bishop, which is usually used when someone's senile. They sent in to sort of take over, but then that fell apart, and it's very complicated.
Isn't that just what you were talking about, though, an example of something sort of welling up? And it seemed to be that there was a lot of early impulse that they were really going to squelch him. And
right.
Then again, maybe thought better of it or narrowed where they were going to squelch him. So it seems like it's another example of this
process.
Back
right.
And forth.
That's
but
right.
What's unusual in his case, though, I think, is that the welling up got to the bishop level. I think it's rare that the bishop himself becomes the example of the cutting edge. And that's what's unusual in his
mm-hmm.
case. Because he not only has the authority, he has the authority as well
right.
as being on the cutting edge, and
right.
that's what's unusual.
Right. Yes?
Well, I think, you know, perhaps it's relevant, is the amount of other welling up that's being done by the defenders of the faith, that a lot of what happened to Hunthausen was by letters being written by people throughout this country to the Pope.
Sure.
According to a priest I know who worked very closely with Hunthausen, he never was told the exact reason for having the adjunct brought in.
Sure.
That it wasn't, you know, these were things that were kind of said and pointed out, but he was never told exactly. And a lot of it seems to be that the Pope doesn't know, or they feel that the Pope doesn't quite know how to react to American Catholicism, that they do not react in the, you know, the way that the European churches and the other churches do to authority.
I think you're right. As a factual matter, I mean, they got thousands of letters from American Catholics saying, we have a heretic bishop out here in Seattle. I don't know, Seattle must be a very strange place. I haven't been out in this area very long, but some of you around here could probably tell me more of the impact he had, but lots of Catholics from around the country, and I wouldn't be surprised if many of the more conservative bishops weren't also on the little telephone and the bishop's hotline to the curia saying, we have a loose cannon on the deck, and with restraint and subtlety, tone him down. Yes?
Well, I think people are forgetting how much of arms are made or airplanes are made in the Seattle area and how many jobs can be lost.
That's right.
Somebody like Hunthausen and he's not paying his taxes, that percentage of his taxes that goes to water.
Defense.
And so there was this political game that went on in the Seattle area. All the negativity was fomented by people that were involved in arms or airplane production. I had written Hunhausen a couple of times myself and got a couple of very good responses, but the return of people taking his side is what caused the change in the Catholic Church's position.
Maybe you should have been writing the Pope. Of course, maybe, are you Catholic?
Yeah, well, kind
of. You see?
More ecumenical. Raised a Catholic.
You see, that's what they'll say. That's the people that are behind him are the marginal Catholics. The true Catholics are not do not go for this kind of stuff. Those who are faithful, who are committed.
But that's not always true.
No.
There's a woman who lives in my building who is the principal of the Catholic school around the corner, and bumper sticker on her car said, "Hunthausen is my bishop."
I just have one last question. If Hunthausen is kind of the left side, maybe?
If you want to use that line.
Is there a real right that's a whole movement
Well, sure. I mean, within in the development of the bishop's letter, you could see this whole process going on. Cardinal O'Connor of New York is the military vicar of the United States. That means he has command of all the Catholic chaplains in the military. And traditionally, the New York Archdiocese has been the center of that kind of thing. But there are a number of other bishops who are extremely conservative, very hostile to this kind of tendency, and so on. But they, of course, like all collective processes, anybody that's ever been on even the tiniest committee knows how this works, right? I mean, they all got behind that door and battled away, and what came out the door was this document. They all signed off on it. Every single name was on there, from Hunthausen's to O'Connor and Cardinal Law in Boston. Cardinal Law in Boston right now is probably the one who thinks that the whole American church has gotten totally out of hand, that it's time to go in and crack some heads and shape things up here and, you know, start improving priests' educations, clearing out the dubious nuns, et cetera, et cetera. He's probably the leader of that tendency in the American church. But they all have to meet once a year up in the hills in Collegeville and, you know, go to Mass and pray a lot together and deal with one another. So it's an interesting process. Yes?
I think a question that was asked by that lady over there is how many people have even heard about some of these pastoral letters? Those of us who have attended sometimes a Catholic church find it very difficult to even get hold of a pastoral letter unless you're in the right diocese. So, or in the right church, you see. I have a copy of the pastoral letter of the Economium next to my chair back home, and I've been going through it, and it's very difficult and very elaborate document that one has to spend a month practically to digest and come down to some details to live with. But I had one on the nuclear war and I misplaced it someplace. But I think I don't know too many other people that are Catholics that have a copy or even have been exposed to a copy of either one of those pastoral letters. But they're profound. They're really 30 something to read.
On the other hand, the National Catholic Reporter, I'm not Catholic, but the National Catholic Reporter we subscribed to for a while, they do...
That's right.
Yeah, print a lot of that. Right. And it's a very informative document for Catholics and non-Catholics to know about social issues within the Catholic Church and what they're doing. It's excellent.
That's where I have a copy of
it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
What happened right after the Second World War in the social movement in the church, or was there nothing significant until civil rights?
Actually, it's rather interesting. That period was one in which the strongest emphasis were on what I would call sort of family, and there were a lot of movements on family and youth and parish and that kind of thing. A whole series of movements, a thing called Cana Movement, the stuff that comes out as Marriage Encounter. So it was, if I were going to do a history of these things.
Catholic Action Groups.
These things that are not so much addressed to the big society, but more to problems closer to home. And of course, again, depending on your point of view, some people say, well, that was a backing off period compared to these labor movements and civil rights. But I don't know, maybe there's a sort of necessary rhythm in that as well. At some point, society or people in society have to think about matters of, you know, how do you run your marriage, how do you run your families, and so on. So there was a lot of that there for a period, and I didn't cover that side of things in my little history, but and it might have coincided, of course, historically. I think that was a period where I had all the GIs, right, coming back and getting married and forming these families and so on, and housing, and, you know, so that was an era in which lots of people thought about that kind of problem. Can anyone else answer? Do these kind of things, maybe we're exaggerating. I don't want to overemphasize, as I say, the impact of these official teaching documents, certainly for non-Catholics. Technically, they have, you know, no authority if you are not a member of the Roman Catholic Communion. But do you see them having impact or Catholic social teaching generally being? Yes.
Now that I hear about them and I've started to read about them, I hadn't paid that much attention before, but they're tremendous ammunition to use with apathetic priests or apathetic bishops, and even apathetic parishes. Mm-hmm. They really, this is the teaching of the church, not mm-hmm. not what you're living.
Right. It seems to me, I mean, I would want to say this about all forms of Christian social thought, not just Catholic, that it shouldn't only be this official teaching, that everyone can apply and think about and deal with these things. So I don't want myself to be saying that this is the only legitimate kind of Christian social thought. To me, it's very instructive as a non-Catholic to think about how this process works in this other communion that is sort of formally organized in very different ways than my own is. Yes.
Yes, I think just the fact that they went about it by having all these hearings, so a lot of people were talking about it. A lot of people felt they were involved in the process. The fact that there was so much publicity given to them, if nothing else, it made people stop and think about a topic that they might not have thought about before, and perhaps discuss it among a few friends. Obviously, even in many other churches, there would be discussion groups that took place on these letters when you could get, when there would be someone who is either very knowledgeable about it, or you could get some copies of it or something. So I think there was a lot of discussion both within the Catholic community as well as the other ecumenical communities on the topic that might not have been there otherwise.
Well, I think it's a really good balance. When Reagan first came out, he said, or his advisors, all you have to do to survive a nuclear war is have a shovel. And that was the first statement by political means to change his attitude that nuclear war basically was not a survivable thing for humanity or social structure as we knew it. And that policy started the Star Wars momentum, which has continued right on. And so it was a good, real, important balance, I feel, to that.
I think as a Christian that's been involved in peace and justice movements, I found it to be very supportive. And I think other people that I've worked with, just knowing that we weren't totally out in left field or by ourselves, it was reassuring, you know, it's a form of legitimacy or something.
Did it give non-Catholic groups any leverage within their own churches? I mean, the Catholic Church seems to have had a mechanism for dealing with it and coming out with something official. I'm wondering if people that were within their own churches or their own church bodies.
It has a limited extent, I think. You know, as much as I could use it, but I think there is. You know, and I would guess that in places that it would have been even more so. But because I think that's if they are looking at any of the religious backings for it, or you're looking at why it was done, those can cut across denominations.
Jim?
Some of the what we might call liberal trends that seem to be offset sometimes by the church's stand on women in the being accepted into the clergy, and birth control for its faithful followers. And have those two issues gone through a similar process of open hearings or? And that's the that's the type of thing you indicated at first coming from the top.
Right. Yeah, and obviously not. I mean, actually, now they are issuing a document on women in the church. The American bishops are. You again, in this whole process, if you were doing this more elaborately, you'd have to say that all these things you have to still relate to the universal church. And the status of all these teachings in relation to the whole church is a very complicated thing. Each of the things you mentioned, birth control, abortion, status of women, ordination of women, each of those ideas has a very elaborate history and a whole place in the teaching of the church. So that from the official standpoint, you're dealing in a whole different set and level of issues. Just to cite one example that I happen to know, for example, the idea of a married clergy, for example, is understood in Roman Catholic tradition to be simply a discipline that the church exercises periodically for its own purposes. So it has no theological status at all. Every good Roman Catholic theologian knows that there used to be married priests, and there could easily be again if they decided to abolish that discipline. Whereas something like the ordination of women is very deeply rooted in the tradition, and they have elaborate, there are thick volumes of theology defending all this. So if you're going to overturn the one policy, you've got one whole, you're up against one whole thing. If you're going to overturn the other policy, you're up against a whole another ball of wax. That's an example of what I'm saying there. But certainly, you know, and again, bishops or teachers of any kind, I suppose, are also participants in a society. And they hear what's going on in society just as well as everyone else. The only difference, I think, is they have this self-understanding of themselves is responsible to the whole tradition. And they have had their hands laid on them that says, you are a direct successor of Peter and the apostles who got their authority direct from Jesus. Therefore, what you say and do, you know, comes by direct pipeline. And that gives you a tremendous, I would suspect, if you're in line to become a bishop, Jim, that you would take on a certain, you know, it sort of makes you sober in what you pronounce, I would suspect. Well, thank you all very much for coming.